Welcome to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm Claire Heddles. Today's episode, Disability Justice in the Time of COVID-19. This discussion is in light of the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, celebrated last week. This landmark 1990 legislation broadened the scope of institutions barred from discriminating against people with disabilities. Today, amidst a global pandemic, debates about school reopening plans, disability rights are central to conversations about the nation's response. In order to make this episode more accessible, Dialogue is airing a live video version of this episode as well. Head to our Facebook page, WUOTFM, to check it out now. You can toggle on live captions through the settings at the bottom of the video on Facebook, or find the video and full transcript at WUOT.org after the show. I have some amazing experts and advocates on the show today to help me unpack these ideas. And due to social distancing guidelines, as you can see, all of our guests are dialed in remotely via Zoom. So first we have Molly Anderson. She's an East Tennessee specialist in family engagement and special education for the ARC of Tennessee, an organization that advocates for the rights and full participation of all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. In this role, she's currently aiding families in navigating Tennessee's school reopening plans. She's also a speaker and disability advocate who successfully lobbied for a 2017 Tennessee law that helped put sign language in high schools across the state. So Molly, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It is an honor to discuss the 30-year anniversary of ADA. I have a nonverbal disability called apraxia, which is a speech disorder. I use assistive technology and sign language to communicate. I use Apple technology to speak, and that's why you hear Siri.
And we also have Dr. Nirmala Arveles, a professor of social and cultural studies and education based at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. Her teaching and research interests lie in the areas of disability studies, critical race theory, transnational feminism, sociology of education, and postcolonial studies. As she describes it, her research focuses on the unruly, messy, unpredictable, and taboo body, a habitual outcast in educational and social contexts. So Nirmala, welcome to Dialogue. And we have Lydia XZ Brown. They are a disability justice advocate, community organizer, educator, attorney, strategist, and writer. They were honored by the White House in 2013 as a champion for change and currently serve as policy counsel for the Privacy and Data Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Additionally, they are the founder and volunteer director of the Fund for Community Reparations for Autistic People of Color's Interdependence, Survival, and Empowerment, an adjunct lecturer in disability studies for the Department of English at Georgetown University, and the Director of Policy, Advocacy, and External Affairs for the Autistic Women and Nonbinary Network. In recent weeks, they have written for the Brookings Institutions about the unique threats of COVID-19 for people with disabilities. So Lydia, thank you so much as well for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And information about our panel and links to each of our guests' work is at WUOT.org. If you're listening in and would like to be part of the discussion, email us your questions at wuotnews@utk.edu or send them on Facebook or Twitter at WUOTFM. So on that note, let's kick off the show. Molly, I want to turn to you first. As we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the ADA, you have continued the work of fighting for disability rights through policy and legal change. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work lobbying for policies that ensure ASL is taught in high schools in Tennessee, and what you'd like to see in the future in terms of disability rights in our state?
One night in college, Josh, boyfriend at the time and my husband now, were studying for classes. I asked Josh, why isn't ASL taught in high schools? He said, I don't know, but I will research it. Come to find out, there was only a 30-year-old law that said it encouraged schools to have ASL as a foreign language. So we sat down and discussed this potential bill with Senator Becky Duken Massey and Representative Roger Kane. They said they wanted to see if it passed the Tennessee Intercollegiate State Legislature, which is a college mock legislature. Josh and I introduced it and passed the bill at the Tennessee Intercollegiate State Legislature. Senator Massey and former Representative Kane agreed to sponsor it. We spoke in front of several House and Senate committees, emailed legislators, even had to compromise with the fiscal note in order to pass it. It passed unanimously in the House and Senate. In the future, I really would like to see texting 911 across the state of Tennessee. I had a wreck in February, before the pandemic. I hit a funeral van with a dead body in it on Chapman Highway. The dead body was okay, but I bent the casket. I panic when I am in situations like these because I can't call 911. Luckily, this sweet woman stopped and called 911 for me. Texting 911 can help many other people in bad situations like kidnapping, shootings, and breaking and entering. I have heard texting 911 will be accessible to Blount County soon. I really would love to see texting 911 across all of Tennessee.
And Lydia, I want to turn to you when we're talking about disability rights. A lot of advocates also use the hashtag nothing about us without us. I wonder if you can explain the significance of this phrase and speak a little bit about the difference and overlap between disability rights and disability justice and what those two terms mean.
Lydia, the idea behind nothing about us without us is that the people who are most directly affected by any topic, any conversation, any idea, any policies, are always the people who need to be at the center and leading that conversation. So if you're talking about issues that affect disabled people, then it is disabled people ourselves and the disabled people who have the least privilege, the least resources, and the least power, who need to be both at the center of that conversation and leading it, because it is only by learning from those who are most affected that we can even begin to shape responses or build things, anything, to challenge whatever forms of barriers or discrimination or structural or systemic oppression that we face. And that helps to explain a little bit the difference between disability rights and disability justice as well. Many people have not heard the term disability justice before. It could be new. And many people who have heard that phrase, but only in passing, could be forgiven for assuming that it is the same thing as disability rights. But the two couldn't be more different. Disability rights tells us that the way to change the situation for disabled people is by changing laws and policies. Repeal or abolish harmful laws, reform or improve existing laws, enforce those laws, and pass new laws to protect people's rights and freedoms. But the reality is that law only protects those who always and already have the most power, privilege, and resources. And even when the laws work, they don't do anything to change people's underlying values and beliefs. In other words, you can't legislate morality. We passed the ADA 3 decades ago. We passed the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act nearly half a century ago. And yet today, disabled people continue to face segregation, exclusion, violence, and flagrant and blatant denial and violation of our technical, legally enforceable rights, even by government agencies and by disability advocacy organizations themselves. The laws exist, and yet they have not fundamentally changed the fact that ableism, which Nirmala will be speaking a bit more about, is all pervasive in our society. Disability justice, in contrast to disability rights, tells us that while we can and should be fighting for laws and policies that mitigate harm and that create opportunity and provide tools to disabled people and advocates and communities, the law will be necessary, but never sufficient. That is, we must keep advocating around law and policy, but we can't think of law and policy as the be-all, end-all, because laws will not save us. They never have, they never will, especially for those most marginalized. Disabled, Black, Brown, Native, and people of color, disabled queer and trans people, disabled people who are out of citizenship status, do not experience any of the same benefits of law that white, rich, degreed, citizen, white people who are disabled experience. And so disability justice tells us we have to fundamentally change societal values. And instead of investing in a system of ableism that only values some kinds of people's body minds and discards the rest of us as disposable and expendable, we have to inculcate new cultural values that affirm that all of us deserve to be here. And we do that by centering those who are most marginalized. And then whatever legal or policy changes we create come out of a transformed public politic.
And a key part of what you're talking about is naming ableism and addressing ableism. So I think for our listeners that may not know what that means, Namala, I'm wondering if you can define that term for us and speak a little bit about the ways that it shaped mainstream discussions around disability, the ADA, and narratives of empowerment.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Molly and Lydia, for actually giving us these real life examples of the kind of discrimination that disabled people face on a day-to-day basis, and especially the ways in which we think of disability as something that has to be overcome or taken away. Now, ableism kind of demonstrates to us these kinds of problematic beliefs. Ableism represents what I would call a complex entanglement of beliefs, concepts, and practices that foreground how structural constraints and oppressive practices construct disability as if it is an aberrant condition in life. It's like we act as if disability has to be gotten rid of. That's what ableism supports. As a result, ableism ensures that the associated violence that accompanies exclusion, segregation, and incarceration, which is usually thought of as a natural condition of disabled people's lives. And that's really the crux of the matter, the fact that the real violence of ableism lies in its naturalization. As a result, we expect to see disabled people in segregated settings like special classrooms, and I hate that term, but that's what we do, to accept inaccessible public space as a norm that requires a patronizing act of accommodation rather than ensuring access, and to render it completely logical for us to think about disability as a confining condition that necessitates actual incarceration in nursing homes, rehabilitation centers, and psychiatric institutions where disabled people are subject to often violent and otherwise banned behavioral interventions like electric shock therapy, among others. So by using this term ableism them in this kind in these mainstream discussions around disability, the ADA, and other narratives of empowerment, I want to shift the discussion from merely thinking about discrimination against disabled people as an attitude that can be changed, just be nice to disabled people, that kind of logic that we have. Look at these amazing disabled people overcoming, and what the late disability activist Stella Young called inspiration porn, these kinds of like feel-good interventions that are basically for non-disabled people to do nothing to change the actual conditions that limit the lives of disabled people themselves. And so as such, ableism as a term is effective in pointing to how disability is not the cause of oppression, but it is society's worshiping at the altar of this mythical notion of the normal that is the cause of oppression. In that sense, then, ableism tells us that reforming attitudes like Lydia was just talking about will not change anything, and even enlarging notions of justice is not enough. To be anti-ableist requires not reform, but radical transformation, and transformation that exists intersectionally with all the other isms of racism, sexism, genderism, heterosexism, classism, ageism. In order to think of disability oppression as ableism, then, it means we need to think of disability as a social and a political condition rather than this medical problem to be cured or normalized. And so that's the way it would shift this kind of mainstream understanding of disability, including the ADA, which is what the critique I'm kind of making of it too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for these definitions and for all of you for laying this foundation a little bit. Lydia, I'm wondering if you can speak to the ongoing risk of care rationing. It's something that you've written about when it comes to COVID-19 and people with disabilities. And what are some of the discussions around rationing scarce resources, and what does that mean exactly?
Many hospitals and states already had policies in place before the pandemic that talked about what a hospital would do if they ran out of medical equipment, if they did not have enough medical personnel available to provide enough care for all of the people who need care. But this issue catapulted to the news for many disabled people because for decades, we as disabled people have survived program after program designed to enact the philosophy of eugenics. That is, the belief that only certain types of people deserve to exist and to continue existing, that some people are better humans and other people would be better off dead or at least better off not reproducing. There's a very long history of what eugenics has looked like in the United States. In the context of the pandemic, what we've seen are disabled people from numerous communities, the deaf community, the autistic community, the community of people with intellectual disabilities, many people with significant physical and motor disabilities who have raised important public challenges to hospital policies about triaging equipment and care for COVID-19. Especially in the earlier days of the pandemic, many hospitals were worried that they might not have enough ventilators to provide to every person who contracts COVID and requires ventilator therapy. Some disabled people even learned that under certain policies, disabled people who ordinarily have ventilators that they rely upon every day for just daily functioning could have their ventilator removed, taken away from them upon admission to a hospital, as the ventilator would then be considered available to any other patient that might need it and perhaps allocated to someone determined to be a higher priority. But what we hear in that statement is, which people were considered more worth saving, more worth keeping alive than others? And we saw a very widely publicized case in Texas recently of a disabled Black man and who had entered the hospital for COVID treatment. And the hospital decided deliberately to withhold treatment, withhold food, and allow Michael Hickson to die. And unfortunately, while this is only one highly publicized case, it reflects the overall reality of ableism in this country, and in particular, what we will call racialized ableism. That is, that as a disabled Black man, Michael Hickson faced a very particular kind of devaluing of his life, of less as less worthy, of less worth living, as less than human. And for many of us now, we have tried to fight against implementation of these types of care rationing policies to prevent their use in depriving care and leading to our deaths. But even again, if states decide to adhere to their own state non-discrimination laws and to federal disability rights laws like the ADA, that doesn't mean that individual doctors or hospitals will necessarily comply. Just because laws exist does not mean that disabled people, especially those at the margins of the margins, will actually enjoy the protections of those laws.
And in talking about those laws, Molly, I know that since COVID hit, the ARC has worked with other Tennessee disability rights groups to bring a complaint to the Federal Office of Civil Rights about the state's guidance around triage during COVID-19 and some of these things that Lydia was talking about. Because of this, Tennessee ended up changing its guidance, but I'm wondering if you can share a little bit more about this change and what it means for Tennesseans with disabilities during this time. Oh, I think your audio might be off, Molly. Let's see.
Due to the worsening.
Thank you.
Means that people with disabilities will not face discrimination based on their disability. In the event that medical resources become scarce due to the worsening of the pandemic or another emergency, one example is that in the past, if a person owned a ventilator and used it to breathe and came to the hospital sick, during a time when triage policies were being used, their ventilator could be taken from the man given to another person. That is no longer the case. We were glad to do this important work and are pleased with the outcome.
And Nirmala, what do you think is important to consider in regards to how people like journalists, policymakers, even neighbors and family members talk about inequity during COVID-19? What are some of the best ways to talk about these disproportional health outcomes in a way that doesn't reproduce harmful ideas that you were talking about earlier in the show?
I'm so glad that Lydia and Molly gave really concrete examples, with particularly around the argument about the respirators and who is basically the questions around COVID-19 are really going around these issues of who has the right to live and who has the right to die and whom do we mourn in these kinds of contexts. And I'm just going to step back a little and rather talk about it in concrete terms to talk about how we think about these things, because COVID-19 is a pandemic and therefore we relate to it in a context of fear. So any person who tests positive for COVID-19 is viewed as a possible vector of the disease and is therefore required to self-isolate in order to reduce spread. Now, while these are facts and I don't dispute them, and as a thoughtful citizen, I am willing to comply, but this response to COVID-19 also comes with a history of how we pathologize people and the harm that pathologization as a social practice can do to communities that are devalued in our social world. So a pathological intervention helps us isolate the agent, in this case, the person that causes harm, and then seeks to destroy it. So what happens when certain bodies are seen to embody this virus? Here, ableism and the way it intersects with race, remember we were saying Black people are more prone to getting the virus, class, you know, poor people don't have the conditions to do this, nationality, the China flu, age, gender, sexuality become evident. You see how these practices work. Inequity during COVID-19 not only accentuates the large disparities in access to healthcare that we know, it is already highlighting the other dangers of congregant care or the lack thereof in nursing homes, prisons, rehabilitation centers, and institutions. And it is because of these spaces are now seen as vectors of the virus, they are pathologized. And so death happening in these spaces is also justified, rationalized, and dismissed as natural, inevitable, and more frighteningly necessary and even useful. Eugenics, as Lydia just pointed out, has never really left us from the 1930s. Only its language has changed and it appears in other forms. So when we want to talk about inequity about COVID-19, we need to shift the discussion from pathologizing bodies. You know, harmful racist comments like the China flu is one example of pathologization, and really talk about the conditions that are causing this virus to spread like wildfire: lack of access to free healthcare, a social income, lack of educational resources, access to clean, affordable housing and healthy food. That's where this discussion should be, not pathologizing the bodies who test positive for the virus. Additionally, because COVID-19 has like long-term effects that can produce impairments that can lead one now to be part of the disability community, it is so easy to once again see disability as a social identity that embodies risk and that embodies a life without future. And that's where ableism again rears its ugly head. And the way to really talk about disproportional health outcomes without falling into this trap of ableism would be that we need to think about a different conversation. And that's where disability justice that we talked about earlier comes into really powerful context here, by perceiving we need to embrace issues of vulnerability and care in a social context that fears any kind of vulnerability, and in a society that celebrates individualism against any kind of collectivity, it is really hard to have these kinds of conversations. And that's where I would love for the COVID-19 conversation to pivot around.
And when it comes to these notions of care, Lydia, I know you've written a bit about technology and care in COVID-19. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of the important things to consider when it comes to online work, contact tracing, digital divide among students, and some of this care mentality that Nirmala was talking about.
This is Lydia. What many people don't realize when talking about virtual work and virtual school for disabled people are that, on the one hand, disabled people have been fighting forever to be allowed to work and learn remotely without having to go to a physical location, which can be inaccessible, cost significantly more time and energy, and create additional barriers to access and participation that are just completely unnecessary. And at the same time, disabled people, especially low-income disabled people of color, are disproportionately less likely to even have access to devices capable of using web content for web-based learning or work. And that number increases dramatically for disabled people who are multiply marginalized, who are institutionalized in nursing homes, psychiatric wards, jails, or prisons, who are often outright denied access to any form of web content. And even for disabled people who can access web content because they do have a sufficient broadband connection and devices capable of accessing web content, 98% of all web content fails to meet the WCAG 2.0 standards for access for people with all different types of disabilities that affect different means of communicating and receiving and expressing information and using web-based technology. That's a lot. So there are multiple layers of institutionalized and systemic ableism baked into the ways that we expect people to learn and work, and how we expect people to participate both during and not during a pandemic. But even worse than that, those layers of inaccess and inequity that overall deprive disabled people of the same ability to participate online or virtually is the expectation that people can perform. We are in the middle of a global pandemic that is a collectively traumatizing experience for pretty much the entire world. Almost everybody is experiencing the daily assault of horrifying, scary, depressing news. More and more people personally have experienced COVID themselves or have loved ones who have contracted it or even died. More and more people know people professionally or from school or in their neighborhood that may not be their friends or their family, but who are also contracting it and dying. We are inundated with conflicting information, simultaneously expected to carry on as if everything is normal and to drop everything and forget about all of the old ways that we had of doing things, both harmful and helpful. And to say that that's not taking a toll on everybody's collective mental health would be a terrible and laughable lie. We are all experiencing a collective trauma experience. And that means that nobody has the capacity to work and learn in the same ways, at the same pace, to the same volume of information or a volume of productive output as we were doing before. And the expectation that students can just return to school on a regular schedule, whether as kindergartners or graduate students or anyone in between, and do the work that they otherwise would have been expected to do on the same evaluation, assessment, and grading system, and perform and achieve is just inhumane and unrealistic. And yet, that is what schools and universities and just everyday people assume ought to be and must be the case. Because for most of us, we aren't thinking more imaginatively about what learning and education could look like during this time, and how we could shift our practices away from measuring and evaluating people based on productivity or output or achievement and adherence to arbitrarily determined schedules on assignments, and instead think about how we can care for people as whole persons instead of just expecting people to meet certain benchmarks.
And I want to shift to talking about education a little bit. And one theory that I think might help frame this conversation is this curb cut effect. The idea that cutting curbs for people that use wheelchairs creates a better society for everyone, from moms with strollers to bikers to drivers. I think this can also apply to talking about education. So Molly, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why making Tennessee schools accessible for students with disabilities during this pandemic is really beneficial for all students that are going to school right now.
When school districts make it accessible for all students, including students with disabilities, it allows for a better community in which students can learn from students with disabilities. Although students with disabilities may not have some of the same abilities and skills, students can learn life lessons from being around them. I will never forget this. I was working at a day camp for people with disabilities. Every morning, a camper would walk in, be so excited to start the day, and sing to us. Because she was so happy to start the day, we all would be in a good mood to start the day. I realized two things. It is better to be positive. And second, positivity is infectious. Students with disabilities can teach others life lessons that will shape how they think about life.
And Nirmala, when it comes to the idea of centering disability can produce better schools for all students, what would curriculum based in disability justice look like? What do you think is missing from curriculums now when it comes to students with disabilities?
Yes, actually what I was going to latch on to something that Lydia had said a little before the break about how, in fact, disability, like the experiences, COVID-19 has laid bare the fact that there were so many practices that we have been doing, that disabled people have been actually championing, that are useful for all of us. And so one of the arguments that I'm making here is that curriculum, when you talk about curriculum, our curriculum that is both in public schools and in education and higher education is completely ableist. It's very rarely we talk about disability outside of the confines of ableism. So we're always talking about, you know, we're talking about it in a medical, we work in silos. And so like, particularly in higher education, the only time you hear about disability is in medical, psychological, and educational fields. And it's usually talked about as a form of pathology, as bodies that need to be normalized, and it's justified through invasive, as I've kept saying that earlier too, invasive and sometimes violent medical and behavioral intervention. That's how the curriculum deals with disability. And you see that in the public schools too. Also, the curriculum is organized to talk about disabled people and not with them and by them, right? So a disability justice curriculum that Lydia had talked about much earlier in the broadcast needs first and foremost to be connected to disability justice activists who are doing the work and are actually producing the knowledge that we don't have to reinvent. That is, in fact, both life-giving, radical, and transformative. Like, disability justice activists were the ones to create the communities of care that folks are now talking about during this pandemic. Disability justice activists have understood what it means to be isolated in education and have found ways to work through this and to produce and find, you know, maybe just live meaningful and also brilliantly beautiful lives. A disability justice perspective is also very intersectional in a way that it forces us to teach across difference and learn across difference and teaches us to build solidarity. It teaches us to think about vulnerability in ways that can sustain our body minds. Part of the trauma that is faced in public schools is because all children are being held to standards that are ridiculous in terms of our body minds. Children of color and queer children in particular are pathologized in schools. So disability justice education or a curriculum will enable us to talk about the ways in which the myth of the normal needs to be eradicated and the ways that we can forge intersectional alliances that can save us all, and not just during the pandemic. It should be like central to our curriculum. And it's not just the content, because disability justice is also a practice. And so would require that every aspect of education, again, as we just talked about here, and Lydia pointed to it earlier, is truly accessible. How do we organize classroom space? Of course, the access to like multiple ways of communicating, of which one is sign language. Question how we have classroom rules that require children to stay in one space or requires children to move in particular ways. Create contexts where vulnerability and being tentative and unsure of oneself is also celebrated to flourish. Actually, if we had a disability justice curriculum, it will totally radically change the ways we can perceive education. And the irony is that COVID-19 and the kind of pressures it has put schools and teachers under is really asking us to rethink the conditions within which we allow an ableist education to flourish without any question, both within pandemic times, but also outside.
And in talking about rethinking curriculum in a way that centers disability justice, Molly, I'm wondering if you can share a little about your experiences growing up in school and what kind of curriculum around disability justice you'd like to see in our local school systems right here in East Tennessee.
Growing up, I was mainstreamed with the exception of speech class. I took every class like general education students. I had an interpreter until middle school. From middle school to now, I used my phone to communicate in class. My school encouraged me to educate my peers on disabilities. More disability awareness curriculum would be a great idea. For example, when I go out in public, like to the store, the majority of the time, people assume I am deaf because I sign. They often ask questions like, do I drive? Did I go to special college? When I do get these questions, I can't help what they assume. All I can do is control my reaction. Either I can get mad or I can educate them. If I try to educate one person, hopefully they will teach others and it will multiply. I wish East Tennessee school districts had more education around disability awareness.
And I'll pose a similar question to Lydia. What conversations would you like to see in classrooms around disability justice? And if you're comfortable sharing, how might this reflect or differ from your own experience or the experience of those that you work with in your activism?
I would love to see young disabled people in schools be connected directly with multiply marginalized, disabled, older youth and adults throughout their schooling. I would love to see curricula in all subject areas reflect the expertise and work of disabled people, whether that's in science or in history or in literature classes, literally anywhere, because we are everywhere. I want disabled young people to know that not only is it possible to grow up disabled and be in the world as a disabled person, but that it's normal and that disabled people are valuable and present no matter what we do and don't contribute. I want teachers to talk openly about their own access needs, about what they struggle with, about what's hard for them, about when they're tired or stressed, and to model what it means to be able to talk about access and to build access together fluidly and collectively. I want teachers to openly challenge that things are supposed to go according to a certain mode of functioning, follow certain schedules, follow certain processes, and question why that should happen, and involve students directly in creating and shaping their learning environment. And yes, I want that to happen even with very young children, because young children may not have the same words or ability to express themselves as the group of us do during this dialogue. But young children have a sense of what they like, what they don't like, what works for them, what's hard for them. And kids aren't always going to necessarily choose the option that's the quote unquote easiest or quote unquote laziest. But even if they do, we should respect and encourage people in exercising their choice and their autonomy and knowing what they need for themselves, when they need things to be easy, when they need things to feel good, and when they're out for a challenge and want to be challenged. I want teachers at all levels of education to care for first and foremost about their students, not just as passive recipients of knowledge and learning, but as co-creators, as co-teachers, as people who get to shape what school is like and who it works for.
Yeah, and I think in talking about this beautiful reimagining of what school could be, I want to open the floor to either Nirmala or Molly. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this discussion about the future of education or what we've talked about thus far in the show? We have about 5 minutes left.
I just want to say that I hold the dream that Lydia and Molly have talked about as so powerful in education. If you've been listening to the conversation with COVID-19 and education and disability right now, it's surprised, it just shocked me, but there's been this concern about special education students, that's their language, and how much are they going to miss when they don't get to school, and that's being used as a logic to force people to conform to the opening of schools in a pandemic. But what Lydia and Molly are saying right now is that that is not the conversation that is in any way liberationary for disabled children. The conversation is about why is it that disabled children have been, in fact, excluded? What would it mean for disabled children to be central to the very functioning of schools? And then for us to re-understand both, not just with disabled children, but also disabled teachers. We forget that they are actually disabled teachers also in the school system are not allowed to identify themselves as such. What would it mean for us to identify in some way center disability, which has historically been in education something that we do away with, you know, we put in a segregated space, to center disability so that it informs almost everything we do about what good education is about. And so I don't think I'm saying anything more profound that I think, but I really think that what both Lydia and Molly were talking about is really what should be shaping how we think about education in COVID and at other times.
And Molly, in your role at the Arc of Tennessee, you help families across East Tennessee access different resources. What do you think are the most important resources school districts need to provide, and how can parents find those?
Most important resource for school districts right now is communication. Parents are hungry for information right now. There are several resources out there for parents, including school reopening plans, contingency learning plans, several different agencies, including Arc of Tennessee, and Support and Training for Exceptional Parents Incorporated, made a worksheet for parents for going back to school. Family Engagement also made a graphic for compensatory services. I do post regularly if I have an update on my Facebook group. If you search East Tennessee Family Engagement and Special Education, I post any resources that I find helpful for families.
And we have just a couple minutes left. Lydia, would you like to add anything else for our listeners before we end the show today?
I strongly encourage everybody who is listening to the show today to take a moment right now to breathe, to feel what is around you, and whatever that means for your body, your mind, to ground yourself in your body, in your mind, to be reminded and to know that you are witnessed, that you are loved, that you deserve care, that you deserve rest, that you deserve freedom, that you deserve justice, that you deserve love, that you deserve these things in your fullness, in your wholeness, in your complexity. Remember that. And if you're interested in learning more and reading about disability justice, a few recommendations. Leah Lakshmi Peepshina Samara Sinha's book, Care Work, Dreaming Disability Justice. Eli Clare's two amazing books, Exile and Pride, Disability, Queerness, and Liberation, and Brilliant Imperfection, Grappling with Cure. Alice Wong's edited collections, Resistance and Hope, Essays by Disabled People, available free online, and the just newly published Disability, Visibility Anthology.
Thank you so much, Lydia.
Lastly, but not least, shameless self-promotion, the anthology that I co-edited with Marenike Giwa Onaiwu and E. Ashkenazi, All the Weight of Our Dreams on Living Racialized Autism.
Thank you so much. We'll include links to all of these resources that you mentioned at WUOT.org on the episode page. And you've been listening to Dialogue, Disability Justice in the Time of COVID-19. I'm your host, Claire Heddles, and I want to extend a special thank you to Greg Hill and Brandon Hollingsworth for their assistance in producing this show. Thank you to our incredible panelists for sharing their insights with us. And if you want to re-listen to this show or read about some of the resources, all of that will be on WUOT.org later this afternoon. Thank you for tuning in. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News on 91.9 FM. This is your NPR news station.